This is Anthony Mims on November 25th, 2014, at NMU interviewing Dr. Ezeguirre on the subject of immigration and acclimation to a host society. What's your birthday?
August 14th, 1960.
All right. And where do we start? Your background. What would you like to start with on this?
Do you mean what I'm doing now, or
this is about immigration. So, your background.
Well, I'm originally from Peru, okay. In South America. I'm from the capital, Lima. I have come to the U.S. a few times for graduate studies. Basically, I did my bachelor's in Lima, and then I did a master's degree here, and then I went back, and then I came for my PhD. I stayed a little bit longer, but then I got an offer and went back to my country, and finally I came back when I applied for this position, and I got selected.
Okay, so you came for the job at NMU, basically.
The one that when I actually intended to move to the U.S. was when I got the previous one were for graduate studies. Although I had some offers to stay in the U.S. for work, but at that time the better offer was the one in Peru, so that's
okay.
The one I took.
And tell me about Peru, I guess.
Well, it's a country in South America. It's very culturally rich country, I would say, because it has a lot of history, different from other countries. You know, it was the center of a big civilization before the Spaniards arrived. And then it became the center of the Spaniard colonies in South America. So it's very rich in history and ruins and buildings
and
culture.
And for you personally?
I live in Lima, which is in the coast of Peru. So it's a little bit different than the mountains where most of these things took place, except for the capital that became important when the Spaniards arrived. I'm an economist that's my education, and I worked over there for some time in the government, and then I worked as in the private sector, and then worked in academia in the university for a number of years before coming to NMU. I don't know what personal details or
was there anything of particular interest to you in the transition moving to the United States?
In my case it has been gradual, because I first came as a tourist. Then I came to stay with some friends like 3 months. Then I came for 2 years to do a master program. Then I came for my PhD and I stayed like 7 years. And then now I move. There are certainly some differences in how things work. Although I would say that we have certain advantage, because the American, I don't know if you call it culture, but American culture is so present in different countries, especially in a city like Lima. It's a more cosmopolitan city. So all the movies, all the TV shows, most of the movies, most of the TV shows, and many of the things the music comes from the U.S. So you sort of have some idea. I think even if you haven't been here, you have some idea if you're exposed to those which not necessarily everybody is, but at least I was. But there are so many subjects, I don't know, that I could talk about regarding difference. Practical level, well, for example, as an instructor, it's a different experience at several levels. First of all, the college experience in the U.S. is very unique in the world, I think. Few resemble the case. Most countries have commuting students. All the universities are like that. There's no campus. I mean, what I mean is with dorms and everything. So people go and leave. So it's just a place to... It's not like a focal point in your life, you know? So that's a different experience. And for that reason, there is very few full-time professors and a huge number of adjuncts. So it's a completely different system. And of course, the students also are different. It's funny that I have been here for many years, and even when I was doing my PhD, I got a chance to taught a couple of courses. When I started teaching here, I started noticing certain differences in you know, what could I expect of the students and what could expect or what the students would expect from me as an instructor. And maybe in part are things particular to this university, and some, I guess, are general. I think at least in my experience, the students are more, I don't know how to put it, I don't want it to sound bad, but more distracted here, more, you know, they tend to talk among themselves more, or to be in the phone. I can see, you know, that somebody's on the phone or things like that. I think the culture is a little bit more improved, a little bit more disciplinarian. I don't know how to put it. So if the professor tells you something, they will do it. You know.
Yeah.
They will do it. So if you just need to say things and play the ground rules, and I mean, not like anybody pushes the boundaries, then that's normal, but I realized that there was some difference, you know, some noticeable difference. And in the style, my style of teaching has always tried to be more active, you know, more trying to get students involved. But in Peru, they are very used to lecturing. So I sort of like, although it's not what I wanted to, the way to do it, but that's what they were expecting more. So it was easier just to lecture. They would take notes, you know, like old style, I would say, maybe. Here, that's not the case. But it was hard for me to find the right way of doing this. More active learning, you know, that fit with the students, you know, what they liked, what they didn't like, and things like that. So that's one experience. Of course, I have lived in Philadelphia, in Miami, in Washington, in St. Louis, you know, at different periods because of my studies. And of course, Marquette is a completely different experience. So it's difficult. I guess the closest would be St. Louis because it's smaller in comparison to the other ones, but still, I mean, this is a town, basically. So there are some differences. Well, actually, that I like, because Lima is more than 9 million people without much urban planning, so it's a mess, you know, like one of those stories that you hear from Asia or from, you know, it's just traffic is horrendous. I mean, everything is disorganized, you know, no well planned. And so that part I don't miss at all. I don't know if there's a focus or there's a...
Basically, we're focusing on the immigration experience.
Okay.
And acclimating to the host society, so you're pretty much right on topic.
Okay. As I said, I benefit from my previous experiences in the U.S. in which I live. It was almost like migrating because, for example, when I did my master was a couple of years, my PhD, I ended up staying 7 years. So some of those acclimating happened then. So it was, there have been different experiences. For example, in Philadelphia, in St. Louis, and then when I moved to D.C. for a year, it's different, for example, in terms of safety. In Lima, well, of course, there are areas in which they are very dangerous, like in any big city, but most of the... I would say the risk of being somebody pickpocketing you in the streets or doing something like that or just stealing your car or something may happen anywhere. I found here that crime, for the most part, it's well located. I don't know, well, that in certain places you're very safe, relatively speaking, they can steal your car still, even in marketing. You know, but I mean, in terms of probabilities of something like that happening, that you find, or even in St. Louis, there were some areas in which you were practically safe, you know, nothing was going to happen to you. I mean, the chance of robbery or burglary or whatever was very slow, very low. But they always tell you, don't go this way, don't go these places, don't go at night to downtown, it's very dangerous, or things like that. In Lima, there is some of that, even though it's a huge city. Because it's a big city, but it's not like you have a whole area in which you can move yourself and feel completely safe. You know, that's a difference. Similar to large cities, we have a lot of homeless people. What you'll see here are the kids begging for money. That's not uncommon over there. Street vendors. All the size of the informal economy. It's almost unseen here, I would say. You don't see a lot of street vendors or people just doing things, you know, informally without any permits or things like that. And that's a large part of a lot of the thing is how you find these things. And it's very informal how you find these things, how you find the best deal, how you find it. Although we already have the malls and the stores where, of course, it's a different, but still we preserve some of that part. I think over the years probably will go away, but weather, of course, was an issue because I usually tend to live in Port Marquette is the stream, but St. Louis, Philadelphia, D.C., I mean, they have snowstorms and cold, but it was a process, but it wasn't, and you get acclimated. Now I go back to Lima in winter and it feels like, you know, like nothing. I don't wear a jacket anymore. If I'm gonna say that what I miss the most is food. I mean, in terms of things, of course I miss friends, you know, but food. Peru is very rich in terms of the culinary we're very famous for our food, you know, in the whole region, and it has over the years have become even better with, and not just the traditional chefs, you know, but now fresh chefs that have been training all over the world and so food, good food is something that I'm guessing that you can get it in New York, in Chicago at a very high prices, you know, which is much more accessible. I mean, good, really good food. And yeah, that's something that I miss. It's not the same.
What can you tell me about the process of immigrating?
Well, the process is, since I was hired by the university, wasn't much complicated. I didn't have to worry much about it. I mean, just do what I was told to do, and all the papers and all the things was complete and everything. And we were all well established in Lima, so it was more, I mean, there were more practical things that I think, there were more practical things about, you know, after we were living almost 14 years in Lima before coming back to the States, so we had a lot of stuff, a lot of things, and so it was more that issue of coming, you know, and taking care of our stuff over there, our properties and stuff like that, and then move. And in fact, my wife had to stay one extra year in Peru trying to finish everything, and I moved first by myself. So, and also I will say my experience it's a little bit particular, because since I spent 7 years when I came for my graduate studies, my kids were born here. They are American citizens, and when we moved back, they went to an American school, and my wife happened to found a job in the American school. So we sort of been connected to the U.S. Even the time that we were in Lima. So for the most part, I wouldn't think, I don't know if I can think that it was a shock or and since I have this gradual process of, you know, moving to the U.S., I mean, I've been here over 4 years in St. Louis, I lived 6 years, so still, you know, it's less than the time I spent there.
Did you have any relatives or anything in the United States before the education process?
Not really. There were some friends of my parents. No, family was not ever a factor I have known of people after coming here and finding out, you know, people that are related, that I knew in Lima, or actually were sort of very, very distant family, you know, but then actually, when I came this time, my wife has a brother living in Salt Lake City. I have a brother living in Montreal, Canada. So, and my wife's niece and nephew from a sister of hers live in Toronto. But that happens actually, let's say, in the last 10 years or so. So not the first time I came. The first time I came, we didn't have any. Basically, the family and families were
in the opposite direction. How many connections do you have going back to Lima locally, or in the United States?
Sorry.
What kind of social infrastructure do you have that connects back to Lima in the United States?
Well. We have a group of Latin Americans in Marquette that we meet from time to time. Actually, we had a big meeting, or big party, if you want to call it, last Saturday. In other parts, in bigger cities, you have the Peruvian club, and here we have the Latin American group. We're not formally in an association, but we tend to, you know, get together at least from time to time. We usually bring our own, everybody cooks and brings their food and share drinks and stuff. And sometimes we do it in a house, sometimes we rent a place to do it. And people come from Iron Mountain, from Escanaba, you know, and they are from different countries, Colombia, mostly Mexico, but Colombia, Peru, Ecuador, Chile, you know, and it varies because people move away and new people come. But you always have a very substantial group, I would say, of families that either one of them or both of them are from a Latin American country, or one that have married an American, that sort of thing. Or some cases they are the descendants, first generation, you know, second generation, would be. The parents came from abroad. So that's something that we do from time to time. So, you know, you eat your food and talking Spanish all the time, and you know. Sometimes we have organized, well, as you know, in Latin America we are Catholic, so we, from time to time, we ask one of the priests that whoever is the priest that better speaks Spanish to do a mass in Spanish at least once a year. So that's the way, sort of like, to connect, you know, to sort of connect with your culture, with your, you know, things that you are used to. It's not perfect, of course, because there are differences between our different countries, but still there is some in common. A couple that is our West friends, she is Peruvian, she works here in NMU, part of the staff. She's also Peruvian, so with them it's even easier because the husband is American, but we can relate to things in Lima, you know, remember things and stuff. And then of course we nowadays with the technology, it's so easy to get in contact with friends, and you know, Skype, emails, Facebook. Facebook is one of the best things, because I think that's because of the fact that I'm from Peru and I'm here, I think I use it more, because I can tell if it was a tremor in Lima, because immediately somebody's posting, because you have a lot of those, and say, oh, did you feel that, you know, and so you know that's happening, or you know, or something, a huge accident happened in this street, and there's the whole thing is blocked, and people are complaining in Facebook. So you are sort of more in touch of what's going on, and people post things that are interesting, things that they found in the news, and things like that. So the connection I think it's easier. I remember the first time I came. It was when I did my master's in Philadelphia. It was harder because, first of all, long distance calls were really expensive, and I had to do it like, and we still wrote letters. That was in the 80s. There was the beginnings of the PCs and the internet, but it wasn't something that many people use, or it wasn't useful. So I remember, you know, writing letters, sending, and And so you had like a week, you know, distance in I don't know how many, you know, like now the things that you do now, I cannot even understand, you know, how we did it. A lot of letters and things like that, and the occasional phone call, and very short because it was expensive. Nowadays, you can be in contact with people without spending any money, basically, or they're waiting to make it cheap in any case. So, but it has become a more globalized because I have some friends that their children have migrated to other countries. I have, you know, some friends that have migrated to other countries. So I think, you know, more people more freely move around. So I myself, my parents are deceased, so my brother lives in Montreal. So immediate family, I don't have him anymore. I have very good friends. That's what I have. I'm my wife's, so part of my wife's family that I also care for. So, but there are ways of connecting, and we try to go at least once a year. Travel once a year, at least 2 weeks or 10 days.
And does that process hold anything interesting or odd?
Well, it's funny because in a way you're gonna be different here because probably you have some, I mean, not extremely, not like you're gonna be completely different, but you may notice some things that you may do different because you come from a different place. But when I go back, oh, I'm also different because, you know, getting used to some of the things here, so it's also felt by others that like I'm a little bit different in the things that I do, you know, like what I eat, for example, you know, it's a little bit different. That I find funny because I probably what we eat at home here is not exactly what most Americans would eat at home. But at the same time, it's not what we eat at home in Peru. So when we go back, you can tell the difference, you know, that we don't want so much of that, you know, that's too heavy for me, you know, things like that. We always talk about the language, that it's funny that you lose faster your the language that you know, that you learn the language that you're the new language. So I'm still struggling sometimes with things, you know, how to say things, come up with words that escape me, you know. But then it starts happening to me in Spanish now because I speak so often in English that some words that you don't happen to use it, and I, oh, how do you say that? And especially, and in the family, you get used to mixing them both and switching back and forth because it's very easy to, you know, you want to say something, even if it's shorter or it's a very fit to what you want to say, and that triggers, and you don't realize that you suddenly change and you're speaking in the other language. And then again, something triggers and you move back, you know, and you go back and forth. And of course, when you are in a place where you're talking to people that only speak Spanish, that's when you notice that.
Turn a list of questions, and I'm like, you've already gotten to this subject, and you've been carrying this interview very well. These questions out of this. Still on the immigration process, because you've covered 99% of the specific fields. what do you find most important to elaborate that, that out of the things you've already discussed, what has your, do you feel needs to be expressed most?
Maybe things, a couple of things that I haven't mentioned, I don't know that I think are important that you notice. It's like, for example, one thing that coming for an developing country, it's funny because when people talk about poverty in the U.S., that's not what we call poverty in Peru. So, you know, somebody that is poor may have a car, cable, and they are living maybe in a small house, doing a low paid job, and that will never be seen as poor. Nobody would tell that person poor in Peru. So that's something that shocks me sometimes when, you know, sometimes people complain about certain situations and I think, well, you know, there are much worse, I'm not talking about, of course here also there are much worse, you know, that people are homeless, you know, but what I'm talking about is that what most of the society considers poor, to be poor, or you know, or that sense of entitlement that the state has to give you these things, you know, to reach certain threshold, you know, of certain standard of living. And in Peru, of course, there are programs to help the poor and whatever, but it's, in the end, it's more up to everybody, anybody, to do whatever they have to do to survive. And, you know, it's funny because I know very poor people in Peru, or not, I would say even the poorest people that do decently, I mean, but no cars, they build their own houses in the middle of nowhere, you know, and little by little, for a while they didn't have a roof, for a while they didn't have a sewage or whatever. I mean, they gradually, you know, have improved and this little tiny house, and, you know, of course they don't have cars or anything, even the chance of getting one, you know. But it's up to them to, you know, people are very resourceful for that. They can count on going to a public hospital in case of an emergency, but for the most part, they have to find a way to live. And something that is even very distant to me, because of course I never had that experience, but people that live on the day, you know, like, it's a lot of Peruvians live that day by day, like, still typical, the husband tries to find something to work on, and he gets back home, and maybe he have $5, and well, that's what they're gonna spend the next day. So they have to buy food day by day by day by day, depending on what you make. And maybe some you save, and you know, if they gotta, from time to time, that person may be hired as a working on a construction site and make some money for a while. They have to try to take advantage of those things to maybe complete a room that they haven't finished, you know, things like that. And that's the way they do it. And it's to me, it's sometimes it's just so sort of shocks me that, you know, when people talk about poverty and the examples that I see are not really what we consider poor. Although I haven't been in that situation, so I'm talking about myself, I'm talking about, you know, if anything, I've been upper middle class in Peru, and when I was professional, in relative terms, I was doing well. Here, probably that translated to here as probably just middle class, but over there was there is this that difference. That's one thing that I found. And the other thing is about all this discrimination and politically correcting, and that it's very hard to follow, because in principle I wouldn't say that Peruvian society does not discriminate. I think there is some discrimination, although it's in certain spaces in which either rich people concentrate or very traditional families concentrate than in the day-to-day. Or in any case, it's a discrimination that goes all the way, you know, like, I don't know. But it's more, probably more, in part it's more income-related, I would say, that. But on the other hand, the subject is not so touchy. It's not so touchy, you know. And for example, if you have dark skin and you're my friend, in a group of friends, we're going to call you negro. We're going to call you black. And if you are oriental, then we're going to call you Chino, Chinese. And nobody, hey, Chino, hey, you know, and nobody, if you're fat, you're going to call you fat, so whatever. If you're short, I'm short, they will call me shorty or whatever was the translation. And there was no issue about it. Many of the things that here is like, don't say that, don't do that, ooh. You know, like there's some sensibility about it. That in part I understand, and I see, you know, that if you really look at what you're saying or how you're saying, you know, but you can clearly tell when somebody's trying to denigrate somebody or when somebody's trying to insult somebody else than when it's just, if you have red hair, probably the people will have a nickname for you, like red. That's not a touchy subject, but some of us are.
In some places, the red hair thing is touchy with some people.
I'm not surprised, but at least for the most part, people, you know.
Yeah.
So, that's my thing. That it's sort of like spreading. Like now, it's like you know, I have freckles. Nobody called me. Which I remember that in Lost, one of the characters was nicknamed by other freckles, because she had a lot of freckles. I'm thinking that maybe at some point that's going to be insulting, you know, like, why are you calling me freckles? Are you going to call anything around my appearance, you know? And I see that, and these things are things that you can say and you cannot say, you know, and very, like, sometimes you feel like you're walking on eggs, you know, like, that. I mean, it's not difficult to avoid these things, you know, not to say things that are offensive. But for example, also something that in Peru it's common to still say kind of racist stuff, like, you know, like double sense, you know, like double meaning of things. hear your emotion, because people can be offended that, that's a sexual, connotation or something, and it's a joke, and sort of like I understand the point, I understand the issue, my intention is not offend anybody, so I don't do anything. I try not to do something that offends people, but that's something that it's very hard to get used to it, because things that are not offensive or not, and you sort of have to live in those two worlds. So I have a very close friend that had an issue with his eyes, and his nickname is Cross Eye. It's not the actual name, it's a slang word for cross eye. I don't know how you have another word for that. But
that I know of.
In Peru, when you have cross eyes, it's called bizco. But also, bizcocho means like cake. So his nickname is bizcocho. And at no point in his life he has been hurt or, I've been called everything that has to be related to the size, my size, my height, I never saw it as I never took it too hard, or never felt like, oh my God, they're putting me down. Although I would say that I have experienced discrimination in Peru, for example, if you meet some extremely wealthy white people, that especially if they have, they're either foreigners, descendants from foreigners, and they are very successful, have a lot of money, or they are come from traditional families, they may put down people, okay? But at the same time, I notice all these things, but I have some, especially not here, because of the population, mix of the population here, but in San Luis or in other places, I had friends, I have African Americans, and definitely I never experienced the same kind of discrimination that they have experienced, or they experience more frequently. Actually, we felt more threatened by African Americans than white Americans. We felt more that they were more aggressive towards us as Hispanics than it's funny, but since I'm a professional, I have a PhD, I sort of feel like in white America, I'm at the most thing, I'm a novelty, not a. Maybe that's a discrimination, I don't know, but it's not like an offensive thing, that they treat you badly or, but I think in the U.S. the issue of discrimination is more, it's more intense, more, and I guess that's what leads into that politically correct things to say and all those things, because it's much more intense, and it was much more, at some point it was harder. I mean, here slavery lasted much longer. I mean, even after the slave was abolished, and there was discrimination, but here was more, maybe there was discrimination, was more informal. Like people actually discriminate, but he was like official, segregation or all that. So I guess the resentment is much bigger, and the in Peru also the with the natives there was a lot of mixing, you know, the people that melted a little bit between the different races, so it's not as significant. So it's there are some groups that try, you know, some small groups that try to preserve their heritage and the origins and everything, but most people are just such a mix of things that, I mean, they cannot say I'm native and the Spaniards came and conquered me because maybe I'm 50% Spaniard, you know. So I have love from all over the place, and very few, I mean, there is a movement of course of going to the defending native Peruvians and stuff, but it's not a huge issue. And here more things were, I mean, and it's funny because there were atrocities committed against the native Peruvians, but I guess the process of mixing even the religion was mixed, you know, they took part of the local religion and mixed it with the Catholic religion, and now many of the key Catholic holidays are got some elements of you know, the sun, the moon, whatever, you know. So I don't know, that all the whole issue, it's hard to explain in just a conversation. That's a completely different, I mean, I think there are discrimination in both places, but it's very different, and this has a different feel. So, and you will tend to think that the issue is, I wouldn't say that necessarily is more important here than there, but here is more sensitive and more intense and more charged than over there. So, I don't know. And of course, we don't have we mostly have shades of from white to Native American. That's the most. The population that came from Africa are not insignificant, but not as significant as here. We have also a lot of migration from Asia, especially from China and some Japanese. That again got mixed, but it's small in numbers. So it's the most important thing is going from completely white to completely native. But you find a whole range, you know. So it's hard to make those make a line and say this and that. I don't know. It's an issue that it's hard to decipher. I don't know how to. It's always puzzles me that I know that there are problems in both sides, but there are differences, and I don't understand completely what the differences are and why they are there. So, but you have to handle it differently, you know. That's something that perhaps was, in a more serious note, was something that was important.
Going back to economics, you were talking about poverty earlier.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned people going off and building their own house. How does the property infrastructure and the debt system there compare to here? Because I can't imagine ever doing that in the United States.
Well, the thing is that because people don't have, for example, a lot of people just do odd jobs. A lot of people just do odd jobs. So you work as a gardener, if there's opportunity you work construction, if somebody you can lease a car and a minibus, and you can do transportation. You can do different things. And you can go out of the city and work in a farm for a while. You know, you can do whatever you will do, and all of this is just under the table. So you don't have anything. And most people that are really poor, their properties have been the consequences of invasions. Of usually, it's state-owned property that it's empty, nobody uses, and there is no park, it's basically desert. They usually move into those areas because nobody cares about those areas. And then try to establish themselves, create an organization, and try to fight it, stay there, fight it for years, and until they're legally accepted, and the word legally accepted, and then they go to the city and they claim on the right to have a road and lighting and all of the services. But they don't have any certain income. They cannot go to the bank. They can never go to the bank. If they borrow money, they will have to be borrowed from informal lenders. And they charge very high interest rates. Usually they do that if they have an idea for a business or something like that, but they pay really high interest rates. But because they need the money for some kind of business, still they cannot get it from the formal system.
So you'd say that the informal economy provides more opportunities, even if they're small opportunities?
Yeah, but of course, since you're in the formal system, you have limitations, like you cannot go to a bank and ask for a because you don't have any proof of any, you don't have any credit history, you don't have any, that hasn't been proven, I must say, but still, and if you see people, the ones that invaded an area and moved like 30 years ago, now they have houses. The ones that moved 10 years ago, they're still struggling. They're still, and what they do is they save in materials. When they have extra money, they buy bricks, they buy wood, whatever they need, and they do it themselves, or they do it with friends, let's make another room, let's finish the bathroom, and that's the way you do it step by step. That's in the cities, basically. That's a city experience. Not many people have the chance of, since they don't have money, they cannot buy a house. As they move slowly, towards maybe the son of this person that does odd jobs, maybe their son becomes a security guard of some company, and now he has a regular income, then he can sort of do all the things because he has some credit history and all that. So it's a slow process. The mobility is very slow. Very slow, it's not as it happens that people that have been poor that become very successful, but certainly the mobility here is much more, I remember I was impressed one, this may seem even silly to you, but for me coming from Peru, this was very early, I don't even remember when, but we were taking like in a tour or in something like that in a bus, and the guy to drive the bus that in Peru, that would be a person that would receive a very small salary, probably his goal is that his children finish high school and try to get a job, maybe some technical job or whatever, and the guy was telling about her daughter that had these scholarships, and he was completing her PhD in chemistry. And I said, that's not possible in Peru. That's impossible in Peru. I didn't say impossible, but unless you have some kind of somebody really helping you personally, because they somehow they care about you, it's very hard, because there's not a formal system of, you know, to do these things, you know. And usually education, the public education is not good, so you need money to get a good education in a private sector. And also in the private sector you have the cheap ones that are really bad quality. Everybody knows that those degrees don't mean a thing, but sometimes that's what they want to get, because they want to have their children going to school, to college. But the degree means almost nothing. To go to a good school, they to rely on scholarships and stuff like that, it's pretty limited, and borrowing for the studies are not as developed as here. You don't have subsidized lending and stuff like that. So it's more difficult to, and also I'm impressed with although we complain a lot about that, but the amount of money that is donated in these things, although the number of foundations and the amount of money that we give, and that's something that you never get in Peru. You cannot rely on those things. For example, when I was doing some research, I never looked for a grant in Peru. Look for grants in the state, in states in Europe, to do some research and to present it to some foundation in Europe or in the states to get some money to do some research. That's not possible, you know. I mean, again, that's almost impossible. So, I don't know. There are different things. I'm going all over the place.
That's fine.
But yeah, and also at the same time, something that is different, for example, is that and this is an experience for a friend of mine, that when he did some exchange program when he was in high school, he went to a family in Iowa. I don't remember where it was. Some Nebraska, I don't know, somewhere in the Midwest. And the family that took him, the father was a plumber. And my friend, the father wanted to talk to him about plumbers in Peru. And he was embarrassed. My friend was embarrassed. He couldn't say anything, because a plumber is somebody that basically doesn't have a job, doesn't have anything to do, and becomes a plumber just to get by. So it's extremely poor. You pay almost nothing, you know. In most neighborhoods, you know, you can look for some area where there are people standing by with their tools. A plumber, you know, and if they get it, if somebody take them, and they can get a job and fix it, and maybe they develop certain customers. But it's not a, like here there is a plumber that has like a company, and maybe later they have some other workers, you know, like a business. Over there, a plumber is somebody that had a, he somehow learned the trade, and from somebody else, maybe the father or a friend of a father, and he learned how to do it, and he's kind of curious about it, and he becomes a plumber, and he fixes things, and you know, and my friend avoided the whole time talking about it, because he didn't want to, you know, like, If he would have tell people that he was going to the state to live in the house of a plumber in Peru, and say, what? they're not going to be able to feed you. They're not going to be able to give you where to stay. You know, you're going to be sleeping with them when, you know, like, there's no space, you know. They must be living in a very, very poor area, and, you know. And according to my friend, the family live in a nice, as you know, decently enough neighborhood, with cars, TVs, and all of the conveniences, phones and everything. So that's something that is different, that it's some of the manual labor are unnecessarily identified with really poor. So if you are in that trade, it's because you are really poor. And because they are poor, they charge very low. So nobody that wants to do that because they like it will go there, because there will be the competition from these other guys that they basically do that because they need to make some money. It will be so hard that they cannot, you know, they will not be willing to charge those prices if they will move and do something else, even if they have the inclination of doing something like that.
Do you think the licensing and legal formalization of those positions creates a division of those who can get those educations and takes away those informal opportunities in the United States?
I think at least in our case, it's better that there's no licensing, because that gives the opportunity to these people to make a living. It's not a lot of money, but it's a shot of having making a living. Maybe the children will be in the position to get a better life, whatever. If you had a very strict system, you know. And what happens is, whenever they try to impose it, they form an economy. You know, people just go around the law, because it's just too, I mean, there's too many people needing to work, and they are willing to work for whatever, you know, to almost for whatever, to make a living. So if you're going to increase the cost, you know, oh, you want to be a plumber, you have to pass to get this license or get the certification, maybe have some studies. You will ruin it for them. That's not the way the way they learn is that when they were kids, they were maybe in their teens, they went and helped somebody that was already a plumber, and then learned the trade. And I guess that was the way it used to be at some point in the rest of the world, but in developing countries, that's the way. And who is good, who is bad? Sometimes you take chances. Sometimes you typically, you know, do you know any good plumber? And here still you do that, but we are talking about a guy, you know. Here probably you're talking a more formal thing, you know. Or it still could be a guy, but it's a formal income, you know, in Peru, it's funny, because when I was living in San Luis, there was this Chinese guy that worked for Honda. He was a very good mechanic. But for all the immigrants, he did, the foreigners, he worked at his house. So you can leave your car at his house, and he will fix it for a much lower price. Of course, under the table. I thought it was funny that I found my, you know, like, the thing that I would have done in Lima, I found it, yes, a little bit in San Luis.
Mechanics seem to be like that across the country, actually.
So, that was, yeah, there are some professions that lend themselves to that. There's some occupations that lend themselves to that.
Because the skill is something that's a little beyond the licensing or teaching can really...
And I think in many of these, many of these things, it's about if the people know how to do it or not. You know, they're good at it or not. You know, their mechanics are, I mean, they haven't had the training. but they have lived all their lives under the hood, you know, and they know anything, and they like to know anything, and they can hear, and they can, you know, and actually, sometimes you think, who cares, you know? Now, with the thing of the computer that tells you what thing is wrong, and that, I don't know if that's gonna go away over the years, but, yeah. I don't know. Anything else? I don't know. I could add. Or anything that you heard that you want me to do?
I'm not thinking of anything else. I'm trying to think if there was something in particular that struck me as warranting elaborating on. Just one last time, is there anything else in your like immigration experience that you feel like elaborating on?
I don't think it's something I've forgotten to mention. Something that significant, but something that, of course, in a more developed country that has a lot of planning and stuff, and people get used to the thing, it's much more organized, like traffic is more organized, you know, traffic is chaos, nobody respects the rules, and you know, things are more, you know, or going, even if you complain about going to do some paperwork in a public office, and it's a pain, you know. It's much worse in Peru, and you depend on knowing people a lot, and you know, getting some help because things can take forever, you know, things like that are more. Work better here. Because it's more structured, more organized, more better planned, so people do what they need to do, you know. Here, it's funny that almost in any situation you get I'm not supposed even to be here. If you are in a situation in which you know, a lot of people are trying to get something, immediately you form a line. In Peru would be like a mass of people, you know. Because I guess it's part of the informality, you know, that being informal and people just making on their own, you know, it becomes very... and you notice even more in large cities, you know, where there is less social structure, less social connections, so they just that's something that it's a little bit different and makes it easier. The other thing is that makes a lot of difference in your life is that labor is extremely cheap in Peru. So I always tell my students in my economic class that you will not find a self-serve gas station in Peru because that's expensive. They prefer to buy a simpler gas dispenser, whatever you call that machine, and hire a few guys to be working there and filling the tanks.
I think it'd still be that way if they got snow like we do here?
I don't know. But in terms of the cost of the investing on those machines versus and the system and all of that, instead of just having guys there doing it, it's just much cheaper. Maids is something very common. Even very low, you know, income people can afford a maid. Of course, it's very formal. The payment, because typically they live there, so they part of their payment is that they live there and they all the meals are covered. So what they have to actually pay in terms of money, it's not that much, because the big chunk, they don't have to pay electricity, you know. And usually they get like a day off, in which they go and visit family, stay with family, and they come back. So it's not expensive at all. So a lot of things, it's like, you will never find, like in Econofood, we bag, you bag. They will have somebody bagging for you. It doesn't cost them much to have somebody. They not only bag things, they carry the things to your car. And in some cases, they go with you to your house and you don't live far away from the place. So anything that it's those kind of services, it's very, you know, delivery, everybody delivers, any place delivers, because it's, and usually they use motorcycles, and because it's very cheap. It's very cheap. So anything that is related to labor, what I'm trying to say is that there are not many things that are automated. There are, but like you have ATMs and those, but there are not many things that are automated as here. And many of the things that, for example, I will not be snow blowing my, we can snow, I will not be, or just mowing my grass, my lawn. I will not be doing that, because it will be too cheap to go through the effort and having the lawnmower and taking care of it and, go get gasoline or whatever, just hire somebody. And even they will come with those without gasoline, but they will do. They will do a whole huge thing and they will do it, and it will cost you very, very little money. So that's something that is that tends to be different. Like somebody will do your laundry, somebody will cook for you. Whatever you want somebody to do for you, it will not be expensive. In relative terms, because very poor people cannot afford that. But for most people, that's not something that is, whatever it is, the service that you can get from somebody is not going to be for that type of jobs.
So does that put more emphasis on positions that require training, or more emphasis on the means of production itself?
I don't get your point.
Economically, if labor's so inexpensive, in order to go up and go up economically, does that emphasize land ownership or the ownership of certain tools of production? What is expensive, basically?
What is expensive? Of course, in general, things are cheaper. So, it will have to be thought of in relative terms. Certainly, equipment, machinery or things like more advanced things, like you can be a carpenter, but you will have very basic tools. And of course, you could be a much successful one if you're able to move on. But for that, you have to be extremely entrepreneurial to move on. You get to that point in which you have your job, but it's not going to be very, it's going to rely a lot in human labor. To move up to a next stage, you need to move into equipment and, systems, delivery, more complex things that not everybody's prepared or able to do that. The ones that have a better vision, or they do that, and they are the ones, the few ones that comes out of that. Because some just sort of find a way to make a living, reach a point in which sort of like they cannot cross, and they try to hope that they help their children to are being the ones who cross the barrier. Few of them have the skills to either naturally, you know, some people are good at those things, just they're born with those, or get some connections of help somehow, and then are able to make the jump and then move to a different level. It's like a barrier that if you cross, then if you're able to cross that barrier, then you can just go off and become even a millionaire. You know? But it's much more difficult for most people.
So
it's hard to get. If you are low skilled worker, to become a high skilled worker, in particular in areas where you can earn more, is very difficult. So that puts, you know, that helps the ones that are high skilled already, but you have a lot of unskilled workers. That's why labor is cheap for all those occupations, because you have too many people doing able to do those things. They compete against each other, so it's not much, they don't charge that much. But if you are able to move to the next level, then it's a different kind of service. You know, it's a different level of service. And of course, they're going to charge more, they're going to have more qualified personnel, you know, and all of those things. But making that jump, I think skills and the ability to get equipment. And usually those things are tied with the ability to access to credit. But it has improved. And banks and some credit institutions have become experts in working with that, within that environment. But it's so big, so huge, that they're able to help, you know, and make money not doing it. There's space there to grow, and over the time it has grown and grown, but still it's hard, you know. The population so large that you're not gonna reach everybody, so there are pockets here and there that benefit from those efforts. That's a key issue, that upward mobility, you know, what it takes to be able to make that upward mobility. It takes a real creative person, or somehow you are able to get the support.
So would you say that the like licensing of plumbers and stuff has put more jobs on the opposite side of that barrier?
I don't think we have licensing for plumbing, but plumbers.
I mean, in the United States.
For some people, yes, but at the same time, I don't know if it's there are people that are. I don't know if it's how common it's that in some certain areas that people just do this informally. I don't know if that's happening in some areas.
I think with some of those jobs, yeah.
Yeah, some of those type of jobs, there are some of that, although it's not. But in any case, in a wealthier society in general, not in Europe, but in general, it's more likely that these licensing costs have less impact than but I think that's a very difficult issue, because in some things it's understandable that you have certain minimum requirements because of some danger. I mean,
Yeah.
You're going to open my brain. I learned. I worked with. I helped a doctor for a while. But I heard that they need license, a special kind of license, very hard to get in Louisiana for hairdressers. Or flower, to make flower arrangements. It's like, who cares, you know? I know people that could make very nice flower arrangements just because they have good taste, you know? But you know, typically the ones that want more of those are the ones that are already in the business. So you limit, you know. So for example, that because that's one of the reasons, for example, in Peru that all those services are cheap because there are so many people that you don't need particularly or highly skilled yet the knowledge that you have learned. And if you're good at it, that's fine. You get a job and you compete. But if there was a very strict enforced license process, it would be difficult for a lot of these people to get a job. But on the other hand, if you were one of those few people that meet your requirements, you will support that, because then you can charge more for your work and get rid of the competition. And I think that in some cases that's what's happening, that happens here, that in different industries that some of the regulations are due to the need of the, you know, some race or something, and sometimes it's just protecting certain businesses from competition. And it's funny that you can find that in many of those things, there are who is supporting those projects. You know, those.
Would you say that for comparison, that pretty much the only industry we have left that's like it is in Peru would be the service industry?
Yeah, I think it's closer.
That's the only one I can think of that doesn't have licensing or something.
Yeah, the thing is that. First of all, the enforcement it's not that strong in Peru, or it's very easy to get around it. And it's just too many people that need this kind of way of making a living, so. It's hard to, you know, to close the door for those people. So I think that makes it more possible to happen here. I mean, to have those restrictions here than over there. And I'm sure the IRS, for example, is more effective than the Peruvian tax authority in catching, you know, first of all, there are so many things going on in Peru that they cannot go after small potatoes, you know. They're not going to go to try to find somebody that works as a plumber, you know. How much taxes are they going to get, you know, out of that? It would be more expensive than to get any money back. In part, it's the same here, there is more rational. I mean, in Peru, for example, when they have found, at some point they found that lawyers, physicians, dentists were doing something similar. They were doing informally without paying, without giving you a receipt, without giving you not reporting taxes, not paying taxes, and many times things like that. They say, well, with or without taxes. Well, that's another thing. Taxes, the sales tax is 19%. Since the inability of, I mean, it's kind of like a vicious circle, because the inability to collect income taxes makes, you know, the need to tax get income from somewhere else, and you know that there is a segment of the economy that it's very difficult to avoid paying taxes, so you're going to swallow the 19%, and other activities that you're, but you know that you're pushing other activities to be informal to avoid paying 19%. I mean, if I hire somebody, I want to do some changes in my house, maybe expand my house or do some extra room or something. I'm going to hire a contractor and everything. If I pay 19% of that, it will be very huge. So in many cases, they do part of it. You know, they charge you part of it with taxes and part of it without taxes. So it's kind of like, you know, that I think here it would be more difficult. I mean, I'm sure it's possible, but it's not as often, you know, not as prevalent as in Peru.
That last thing we're going to talk about?
I don't know what.
I mean, we covered all my bases. I'm just.
I'm trying to think if I missed anything that. I'm sure I'm going to remember something later. It's like, oops, I didn't mention this. I will say that in terms of migration, and this is more general, not just my experience, still the U.S. is seen as with all the troubles and all, the U.S. is seen as a place to move to, you know. If I would have gotten the same job offer in some other country, I don't know if I would have taken it. This is what I wanted to do. I wanted to get this kind of job. The university experience is very different in Peru than here. So I wanted that experience. It came just by chance that the opportunity that I find out about this job, and I was, so the match was very, very good of what I needed and what I could offer. So in that sense, it was kind of like an odd case, but I don't know if I would have, if they told me that, you know, what, you want to do this in Germany, I will feel more, even though we have several, I'm affected by, I'm biased because I did my studies here, but even before that, I considered doing my grad study in Europe at some point, but it seemed far removed from even you could go to Spain, for example, which the language is not an issue, but the U.S. seems to in comparison to the other ones, the U.S. is clearly visible, you know, like as a place to go and do things. So, and the same, although at some point you asked me a question about if I have family or anything, but you know, if you move to the U.S., there's going to be people that have moved to the U.S. You know, there's going to be a lot of people that have moved to the U.S. And you're going to find out that, oh, do you remember that cousin that you had, you know? Oh, she's living in San Francisco, you know, whatever, you know. And I get connected with Facebook, and we say, I'm not going to go there, but it feels a little better that, you know, to know that other people are around. So I think there's still a special attraction to the U.S. and I guess, especially from Latin America, I guess, that we're closer. I think maybe Africans go more to Europe, perhaps that's the case. And the influence of the American culture, the brands, the stores, the music, the movies, the TV shows, all of those things that you see since you are little, I guess it has an maybe even unconscious impact that you always consider the U.S. as a valid option. And at the same time, since there is so much immigration, for example, I was talking about food. I know that I in Marquette I cannot get anything, but for Thanksgiving I'm going near Chicago to visit some friends, and I know I can go to some store over there and get all the things I need. If you live close to a big city like Chicago, New York, Washington, or you're gonna find a place where you can get some of the things that you would like to buy. So that also helps that it's so, there's so many foreigners living in the U.S. that even if you look at Northern and you look at the faculty that are from other countries, it's a good number.
I mean
it could be from any place, in Germany, UK, whatever, but there's a good number, and that's not in Peru you go all the, it would be rare to find some foreigner teaching there. In Europe, I'm sure they are, but I'm sure there are not as many as here. So that type of in a way, in spite of all what we have talked about, I think it's still for immigrants, it's a better place to come.
So no matter the economic situation, the history of immigration has like an inertia effect.
Yeah, even though that people discuss about immigration, and I think that most of the big discussion is that a lot of people that actually has diminished because of the economic situation, that people that cross illegally and get them jobs with no much education, a lot of needs. But a lot of the, the U.S. take advantage of being an attractive place to get the better human capital around the world. I'm not talking about my case, but you get people to go to the Silicon Valley from different countries that are really good at what they do, or those research universities, they hire somebody from India, somebody from China, whatever, and they get a very good, high levels of human capital that give an advantage. But at the same time, I think it's easier in spite of all what we have talked about, it's easier for somebody to migrate to the U.S. It has certain advantage in comparison to some countries. I have not migrated to other countries, so I cannot be certain, but it's my feeling that it's not strange that I'm going to walk and I'm going to find, for example, in this small department of six, I'm Peruvian, my next door colleague is from Taiwan, and if you go in this building, there are a couple of more that are from other countries, in this floor, in this building, and if you go across campus, you're going to find more. So that makes you feel more comfortable, even though the culture may be different, but just the fact that there are always people from other countries coming or being around you, that feels you more,
the shared experience of not being from here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so you feel more comfortable, yeah, I would say, for that reason. I think that's one thing that I probably mentioned before, that I should not left out. I should not be left out. So.
Okay. I think we can wrap this up then.
Okay.
It's been a great conversation.
I hope it helps.
I think it will. Thank you.